Well, if you've been in the church for any length of time, but specifically I'm thinking of those of us who've been in the church for the past few decades, you more than likely have been shown a whole different and variety of various ways of interpreting Revelation. You've probably seen, and if you've been part of the charismatic Pentecostal world as well, like I have been, the most predominant way of understanding Revelation was that we had to crack the code. Like we had to engage in this effort of decoding all of the numbers and symbols and all of those things and try to fit them into a particular chronology and timeline that would give us an indication of how things will play out in those years preceding the return of Christ. You've probably seen all of the different end times charts and timelines like I've got up here, right? It's hard to read. There's so much there. You know, all of the events there, looking at the prophecies of Daniel and looking at the prophecies in Revelation and trying to figure out, you know, what are the 70 weeks of Daniel? What is that remaining week? Is there an actual literal seven-year tribulation period? Is there an actual 1,000 literal years of the millennial reign of Christ before the new heavens and the new earth? What about the seven seals and the seven bowls and the seven trumpets and the beast rising out from the sea? Who is that? Who's that mystery woman in scarlet riding the beast with seven heads and 10 horns? Like, that's crazy. And we, you know, we try to put it on a chart and figure out how that matches up with world events. Some of you may have seen it. It's an old war movie, maybe about 20 years ago it came out, U-571. It's a fantastic war movie, and it's a U.S. submarine that attempts to capture a German U-boat during World War II. The Germans used this thing called the Enigma cipher machine to send transmissions to their troops, and it encoded their transmission, and so they would intercept those, but they didn't know how to decode that. So they wanted to capture this U-boat, capture one of these Enigma machines, which they did. Now, in real life, mathematicians and those who engage in cryptography and all of those things attempted to try to hack and crack the Enigma cipher machine, and eventually they were successful, you know, but it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. And many of us approach Revelation this way. If we can hack the code, if we can crack the code, if we learn how to decipher all of the symbols and all of these things, you know, then we can understand it. If we're able to decode it, then we can determine who the Antichrist is. Wouldn't you like to know who the Antichrist is? So we can call him out by name, right? And if we're successful in decoding it, we can determine what the number 666 signifies and what's really the mark of the beast. Because if we can do that, then we can warn Christians about the mark of the beast to make sure they don't take it, right? We've approached Revelation in this fashion. Some approach it with like this end time fever and hysteria. And I came up in the church kind of during the heydays of that, towards the end of the Cold War. Like, there was rapture fever. I've talked about it in our past series, you know, which led to all sorts of just crazy stuff, you know, debacles like the Harold Camping end time hysteria in 2011. That's probably one of the most recent things. You know, Jesus was going to return. It was the end times. Everybody stocked up on food. Some sold all their possessions and moved to the mountains, you know, because the world was about to end. And here we are 10 years later. The world has not ended. Some now are sounding that trumpet again, right? Because with COVID and global pandemic and all of this, is this the end times? Are we to prepare because Christ's return is imminent in our lifetime, right? We want to know those things, but it becomes an end time obsession. Joel Beakey, in his commentary in Revelation, wrote this: "The Bible was not written to satisfy the hunger of the human mind for knowledge of future events. Many Christians use the book of Revelation as a kind of horoscope to predict the future. They might as well read the stars. The Bible is not a horoscope. It is a revelation of Jesus Christ. It is to be understood rationally, spiritually, practically, not superstitiously or speculatively." Now, I was not taught to interpret the book of Revelation this way. I was the one with the charts and trying to interpret the charts and try to figure all this out. And I think most of us in this room probably come from that background and that understanding. But we've been focused on the wrong thing this whole time. And what that ended up doing in us is skewing how we're actually supposed to interpret the meaning of Revelation, how we're supposed to understand the message of this book. It's not a puzzle book. It doesn't contain encrypted stuff that we have to labor hard to try to decipher to gain the meaning. It's not a puzzle book, I've said repeatedly. It's a picture book. It's a picture book, and we need to understand the pictures, understand what John was trying to convey through these pictures, but not try to decode them like they're a puzzle or a code to crack. The genre of Revelation, as I've said in our past series, is apocalyptic for sure. It talks about end-time prophetic things. It is prophetic, right? The structure of it is like the prophetic books of the Old Testament prophets. But more importantly, Revelation is a pastoral letter. It's a pastoral epistle, just like the other ones, James and 1 Peter and 1 John, all of the writings of Paul. In the same way we view those as letters for our edification, our encouragement, things that are relevant for our lives today as followers of Jesus Christ, we need to see Revelation in the same exact manner. It is a letter to the church. It's as applicable for us today as it was for its first century audience. Now, today's message is going to be, as I said, foundational to help us understand the principles of how we're going to interpret Revelation, because that's really important. It's going to guide how we interpret the book, this amazing, beautiful, prophetic, yet terrifying book of the Bible. Because rightly interpreting this book is going to draw us to worship Jesus Christ, to a deeper worship of Jesus Christ. It's going to provoke in us faithful endurance, which is one of the clarion calls, right, there that we find in Revelation, as it was in each of the letter to the seven churches that we looked at. It's going to ground us in the events of history and fill us with hope. As brothers and sisters, we are on the winning side. You believe that? Yeah. We need to be optimistic as we read this book, because we are on the winning side. The message is loud and clear in Revelation. Jesus wins. And not only does Jesus win, the church wins as well. All right? So we need to see it that way. All right, let's turn. We're going to be back in chapter 1, just the first few verses. I'm not going to teach through all of chapter 1. I did that in our last series. But let's turn to the first chapter of Revelation. We're going to read the first three verses and verse 19. Okay, you can follow along on our worship guide at sent.life as well. Hear the words of the living God. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant, John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all he saw. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. Write, therefore, the things that you have seen, those that are, and those that are to take place after this. These are the words of the Lord. Now, Revelation opens up with this important phrase, the revelation of who? Of Jesus Christ. This is not the revelation of John, as many people call it. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ. John gets to write it down, right? But it's not John's revelation. It's given to him, but it's not from him. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. John's the messenger. He's taking dictation, right? What Jesus speaks to him and what he sees, he puts down. But the revelation is of Jesus. It's of his glory. It's of his triumphant victory, his kingdom, and his power. That word in the Greek for revelation means to disclose something that was previously hidden. And we're going to discover what some of those previously hidden things are throughout our study, but now they've been disclosed. Now they've been unveiled. And notice that it's a revelation of Jesus Christ. It's not a revelation of the end times. It's not a revelation of the end of the world. It's not a revelation of the tribulation period. It is ultimately, primarily, a revelation of Jesus Christ, the one whom John sees in the opening vision is that of a Son of Man in all of His glory, in all of His majesty, and in all of His splendor. He is both the revealer and He is the revelation. He is the agent of the revelation and He's the revelation itself, the object of it. So our first thought when we come to studying Revelation isn't, what can I discover about the end times? What can I figure out about how the world is going to end? That should not be our primary approach to reading and studying the book of Revelation. The primary approach should be, what can I discover about what Jesus has revealed about Himself? What can I glean from that revelation for my edification, encouragement, and comfort as I go through this life? Goes on to say, which God gave Him, Jesus, to show to His servants the things that must soon take place. Who's the revelation given to? It's to His servants. Who are His servants? We are His servants. It's to the church, because who were the recipients of the letter of this book? It's the church. It's the seven churches, but those churches represent all of the churches, the universal church of Jesus Christ in all times and all places throughout all successive ages of human history. It is for us. We are the intended audience of this revelation. It's God's people. And what is it conveying? What must soon take place. Now that phrase is interpreted many different ways, but I'm going to say this over and over and over again. We have to interpret Revelation in light of what God's Word has already declared about things, specifically the Old Testament. We cannot understand Revelation without understanding the Old Testament. And this particular phrase, John is calling back to Daniel's vision in the second chapter of Daniel. In Daniel 2:28 specifically, that's where this phrase is coming straight out of. And there, listen to what Daniel says when he approaches the king, because God had already revealed to Daniel the contents of the dream that the king had had, and he's now coming with the interpretation. Daniel 2:28, this is Daniel speaking to the king, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and listen, He has made known to the king, what? What will be when? In the latter days. The latter days. Now, if you recall a little bit of that story, Nebuchadnezzar's dream was a great image that appeared before him in this dream. And this image was in a massive shape with a head of gold, right? He had the head of gold. He had the chest of made of silver. The middle thigh and thighs were of bronze, the legs of iron, and the feet were this mixture of iron and clay. And then he sees a stone that comes. It was hewn out of a mountain, but not from human hands. And now this stone comes and strikes this great image at the feet, fracturing it in pieces. And this stone then becomes a mighty mountain that ends up stretching to and expanding to and overtaking the whole earth. And he has this vision, and he's desperate to know what it means. None of the other magicians, none of the other court officials could interpret this dream. And here comes Daniel with the revelation from heaven. And he gives the interpretation to the king that these all represent this succession of great empires, from the greatest, which was the kingdom of Babylon, to the least, the mixture of the feet of iron and clay, which ends up being the Roman Empire. And the stone represents the kingdom of God, this eternal, unconquerable kingdom of God that's going to expand to the whole earth. And for Daniel, the events of that prophecy were things that were going to happen in the latter days. They were future-focused. The kingdom of God was not there yet. It was coming. But what is John declaring here? He's not declaring that things are going to be happening in the future, but he's saying that must soon take place. There is an imminency that it's happening in his time or soon thereafter. So he doesn't see that as something far off, but that the kingdom is here and now. In fact, that's what Jesus declared, right, when he came. What did he say? The kingdom of heaven is where? It's at hand. It's present. The inbreaking kingdom. So he's both speaking and showing these things now, in this revelation, what must soon take place. So you'll hear John reference many times in Revelation, I saw that. He is seeing something. There are images playing out before him. I don't know in whether he was dreaming, whether it was an open vision. We have no idea. But this revelation is coming to John here. And he's saying, I saw. So he begins to write these things down, because that's what Jesus, in verse 19 that we just read, instructs him to do. Things that have been, things that are happening, things that are going to take place. Now, after the threefold blessing that we read there in verse 3, again, there's this other indication of the urgency. The time is near. The appointed time. A time somehow predetermined by God is near. It's not a linear time as we understand it, but an appointed time, a designated time. And when you read that phrase, right, it's code for the last days. The time is near is like saying the last days. We're in the last days. You know, in 2 Timothy 3:1, we read this in Paul's admonishment here. You must understand that in the last days, there will come times of much trouble. The last days, there'll be much. And so we've come to understand the last days, and we think of it as something far off, a time where trouble intensifies immediately preceding the return of Jesus Christ. That's kind of how we've all kind of come to understand this. But it should not surprise you, right, as good Bible students, that we have been in the last days for 2,000 years, and the last days have not yet arrived. There is the already and not yet reality of what we experience as followers of Jesus Christ. We have been in the last days since the resurrection and ascension of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, the Old Testament, as I've said, has a lot of references to the latter days, that they were looking forward to the fulfillment of the promised Messiah. That was the latter days, right, to the Old Testament saints of God. The anointed son of David, the one who would establish this eternal kingdom that he would rule over, right? These were the latter days that they were looking forward to, right? But what happens? Christ appears. The Messiah comes. He is the fulfillment. He is the consummation of those last days' promises. He's the fulfillment of that. So when we see that they were looking towards the last days, the latter days, here comes Jesus, and now he inaugurates the kingdom. The old covenant is closed, and he inaugurates the new covenant. And now in this new covenant, we also have last days promises. Okay? So what are those last days? Well, these promises that God made are being fulfilled in these last days until they are fully and finally fulfilled on the last day. What's the last day? The return of Christ, the final judgment. That's the last day. So we're in the last days until the last days, all right? I'm not trying to be a tongue twister, but I want you to get this, right? And all of the New Testament writers recognize that we are in the last days. I'm going to pull this out here. I don't know what's happening with it. We'll try it over here. I'll try not to jiggle around too much, maybe. All right? So all of the New Testament writers recognize that we're in the last days. That happened with the resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ. So in 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter writes, he was foreknown, Jesus, before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest when? In the last days, for the sake of you. Hebrews 1, 2, first part. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. Then we see another fulfillment of the last days with the outpouring of the Spirit at the day of Pentecost. Second chapter of Acts, verse 17. In the last days, this is the prophecy of Joel, right? In the last days it shall be, God declares, I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh. Well, guess what? On the day of Pentecost, he poured out his Spirit on all flesh. That's the last days. So we are in the last days, we have been in the last days, and we will be in the last days until the last day. Make sense? All right. We need to understand that. Now, whether we will see the last day during our sojourn here on earth, Will he come in our lifetime? No, that's in the wisdom and knowledge of God alone. We cannot know that. This is why it's foolish to try to set dates and times of his return. We don't know that because we've been in the last days for 2,000 plus years. How many more last days are there? We have no idea. And as we study Revelation, I hope you begin to see more and more why it doesn't matter for us to put a date and a time to that. And why more than likely it's not in our lifetime, though we should live with the urgency of his imminent return as if it were in our lifetime, okay? So that's important, right? The revelation of Jesus Christ is for his servants during these periods of the last days as we live in anticipation of the last day. So how are we going to understand Revelation? How are we going to interpret all of the stuff in Revelation? Like if you've read Revelation, your head kind of spins around, doesn't it? I mean, like, really, there's a lot of crazy stuff in there. These are bizarre visions. They're bizarre images of things that, like, we try to sketch them out and people try to draw them, but we have no idea how John saw these things, but John is conveying something about the images he sees here. Now, there are five main interpretive views of Revelation, right? Five that we're going to cover. There are variations of these. There are nuances to all of this. So I'm going to be very general with these, and then I'll share with you the one I lean towards there and how we are going to, and the one we're going to use basically to interpret Revelation. The first is the preterist view. That word preterist, right, is a fancy word that comes from the Latin, and it just means that which is past, right? Past. So the preterist view sees Revelation here as events and prophecies that have already been fulfilled in the past, with the exception of those particular things about the return of Jesus Christ, his second coming. Now, this necessitates that Revelation have a much earlier date than what we've already looked at as the common understanding of the date of Revelation. We have talked about Revelation being dated in the late first century, 89 to about 95 AD, somewhere in that place. John was a much older man at that particular time. It would have made sense, right, the condition of the churches in Asia Minor, you know, for a much later date than what preterists have to date Revelation as. They would have to date Revelation somewhere in the mid-50s, maybe up to 60 AD. Why is that important? Because the preterist sees all of these events in Revelation having been fulfilled with the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. In 70 AD, Rome sacked Jerusalem and just decimated the city and destroyed the temple, and that was really the signification of the end, you know, of the old covenant, right? No more sacrifices, no more sacrifice system. The Jews couldn't sacrifice animals anymore. Temple's gone, right? They see this as the ultimate fulfillment, the ultimate judgment of the prophecies in Revelation, with the exclusion of those events there in the last chapters of Revelation, right? So that's how they understand this to be. Only those future events that will happen closer to the return of Christ is all that's left. Now, there's a lot of believers who hold to this particular view. So the things that Jesus talks about in Matthew about the last days are specific and unique to all of those things that led up to the fall of Jerusalem and destruction of the temple. The challenge with that view, and there are numerous ones of them, even though it has some positives and strengths, is that, again, we have to have a much earlier date from Revelation than is likely. And secondly, what consolation does that view have for the Church of Jesus Christ today? What consolation does that particular view have even for the believers that John wrote these seven letters to that were undergoing suffering and persecution during their time? Like, this letter would have offered no consolation because the events would have already happened. It happened before their time. So what are those promises all about and for? Second view, and this was the most common view around during the time of the Reformation, was the historicist view. And this particular view sees all of the visions, like the seals, the trumpets, the bowls, all of those things,
as the successive ages of the church. So they'll look at the letters of the seven churches, and many of them hold this view, and say that each of those letters represents a particular age of the church, starting with Ephesus, the first age of the church there in the first century, moving on through Smyrna and Pergamum and Thyatira and Sardis and Philadelphia, that now we are in the age of Laodicea. Isn't that comforting to know, right? The longest age of church history right now is the lukewarm, nausea-inducing spirituality church of Laodicea. Right? They would read that as the successive ages of the church. So each of the symbols that you find, whether it's in the seals, the trumpets, the bowls, all of those symbols represent a specific event in the history of the church, or it happened during the history of the church. So they would see some of the seal judgments or the trumpet judgments, and they would look at those and say, well, that has to do with the fall of the Roman Empire. Oh, well, that has to do with the mass persecution under Diocletian, or that has to do with the rise of Constantine and Christianity being established, or this has to do with the Dark Ages or the rise of Islam, the corruption of the papacy, the Reformation, all of those particular things. Right, so you can imagine this particular view, it kind of makes it difficult to interpret the symbols, because we have to try to figure out what do they correspond to in events in human history. What events were these really about during the particular church age? How do you do that? How do you figure that particular out? Now, a few commentators have noted that this view seems to emphasize the history or more of the history of the Western or European church, right, to the exclusion of everyone else, okay?
All right, so that's the historicist view. Now, the third predominant view there is called the futurist view. Now, the way this view is, now this is probably one of the most popular ways to interpret Revelation. In fact, this is what I grew up studying Revelation. It was this particular view that helped with interpreting that. So with this view, everything in the book, with the exception of the letters to the seven churches, prophesies all of the events that are going to take place around the return of Christ. And when Christ returns, he's going to usher in his millennial reign, and at the end of that, Satan is going to be loosed once again, and then he was going to be finally and fully defeated, and then we'll have the new heavens and the new earth. That's been the dominant view since the early part of the 20th century, and you can thank Scofield and his study Bible for that, because he popularized this dispensational view of understanding this, the futurist view of understanding the symbols in Revelation. And that's the main form of this view. It's called premillennial dispensationalism. Premillennial dispensationalism, right? And that simply means dispensation has to do with ages or periods, and premillennial is that these things are going to happen before the millennium, all right, in Revelation, that 1,000 years that are mentioned there. So with this particular view, the visions are taken literally. So when it says a beast is going to rise up out of the sea, a beast is going to rise up out of the sea. Now, some say it's symbolic. Most of them say, well, no, these are literal events. So we have to try to understand what they're going to be or how they're going to look like. And they're going to happen chronologically. So just like it's laid out in Revelation, the first seal, then the second seal is open, then the third, then the fourth, then the sixth, then the seventh, which has the seven angels with their seven trumpets, and then those plagues that are listed out there, and then the bowls, and all of these events happen linearly, literally, and sequentially. Right? So there's a rapture of the church typically before the tribulation, a literal seven-year tribulation. There's the reign of the Antichrist. There's nations making war with Israel. There's Christ's return and the defeat of his enemies at Armageddon. Then the establishment of the 1,000 years. Again, Satan has been bound up during that time. Then he's loose. Then he tries to make war with the saints and with the Lamb, and Christ defeats him, on and on. Right? So this is how they see this playing out. And a challenging thing with that view is it tends to disconnect the visions there from 4 through 22 with the events we've already looked at in the letters to the churches. And they're not disconnected. And I hope you see that as we go through Revelation. I'm going to be tying things from the letters we've already studied to what is referenced in the visions there to show you that they're not disjointed. They're not disconnected. Okay? And it doesn't make sense apart from that. Again, same thing with the other views there. It doesn't offer much consolation to the suffering and persecuted church, which were the intended original audience of these particular letters. And it's not going to offer us a whole lot of consolation either, because everything is focused on this extremely narrow time of human history, about 7 years. And all of the attention is focused there. Fourth main view is the idealist view. And in this particular view, Revelation is to be interpreted largely as a symbolic presentation of the cosmic battle between good and evil. The events described in Revelation are events that are repeated over and over again in human history throughout the entirety of the church age. It's the repeated experience of the church age in every age, and the book exhorts believer in all of those time periods to remain faithful to the Lord in the face of suffering. So when we look at the events prophesied in Revelation, they speak to every single generation of believers, thus making Revelation relevant for all Christians. Now, this particular view sees the events in the book as having found their fulfillment in countless events throughout the church age. And so in this sense, right, we can look at the events of this book finding their fulfillment in a variety of things, in countless human events. So when we look at these other three views that we've seen already, from the futurist to the historicist to the preterist view, those three views exist because, again, a symbolic representation of the events can find their fulfillment in any event of human history, whether it's the fall of Jerusalem, like the preterists say, or it's mass persecution of the Roman Empire in the 3rd and 4th century AD, like the historicist would see. Okay, all of those can find their fulfillment in that. We can look at that today, whether we look at all the things from human history, like plagues and famines and world wars and all of these things, right, or any future apocalyptic scenario. All of those events are fulfillments of the particular visions here. So there's the visions have multiple fulfillments. They're part of a general pattern. And again, why is that important? That means it's relevant today for us. Okay? The idealist does not approach the visions as sequential or chronological. So it's not first the trumpets, the seals, then the trumpets, then the bowls, right? There's another way. It's a looser interpretation, and I'll go through that in a moment here. So there's no need for the complex charts that we looked at. There's no need to try to figure out this sequential linear timeline here. The symbolism has a looser interpretation, which therefore gives comfort and encouragement to persecuted Christians in all ages of the church age. And the fifth particular view is what many commentators and scholars call the eclectic idealist view. All right? So it's the idealist view, all right, by and large, right? But it also recognizes that there are valid elements and merits to each of the other approaches. So it's going to draw from the strength of each of those particular approaches while rejecting the weaknesses of those particular views. And this is the view I have leaned to for a number of years now. And I think it's probably the safest and best approach to understanding and interpreting Revelation. So it's the approach we're going to take. It's by and large the idealist view, but we are going to draw from the other views to show you how it's important to understand this book, which leads to this next part here. Is everything in Revelation symbolic or is it literal? Symbolic or literal? How do we interpret that? Well, when we look at Revelation, it's packed with symbols. It's packed with numbers. It's packed with images of creatures and geography and climate and colors and all of these particular things. Just look at some of the numbers referenced in Revelation like this. The number 2, the number 3, the number 4, the number 6, the number 7, right, which is the the most important number that we'll find in Revelation, hence the title of our series. 10, 12, 24, 144, 666, 1,000, 12,000, 144,000, references to 42 months, references to 1,260 days, 5 months, all right? All of these numbers are found in Revelation. Are they to be taken literally? Are they symbolic? We have a variety of colors mentioned. White, red, scarlet, green, purple, black, pale is what John sees in these particular visions. Are they accurate, true, literal representations of those colors? Or do they mean something else? Gems and precious stones mentioned. Jasper, emerald, sapphire, topaz, to name a few. Symbols. Lampstands, scrolls, trumpets, seals, bowls, books, four horsemen, scales, winepress, crowns, pillars, thrones, altars, incense. Is that literal things, literal symbols, or are they symbolic? These climate features and earthly or heavenly features like clouds, water, seas, rivers, thunder, lightning, trees, mountains, sun, stars, rainbow, lake of fire, flood, earthquakes, and so many other things. What are all those things about? How about the creatures? Those four living creatures around the throne of God and what they each represents. Lion, ox, eagles, the face of a man, the lamb that looks like it was slain with seven eyes, beast that rises out from the sea with seven heads and ten horns, sheep, right? Scorpions, serpents, dragons, like that's all in there. Like, that blows your mind as you're reading through Revelation. Yeah, there's so many other things, different places, plants, foods, medicine, spices, precious metals, and different people mentioned there. There is a whole lot there in 22 chapters. How are we to understand these things? How are we to interpret them? Symbolically or literally? Now, J.K. Beale, in his commentary, suggests that the old dictum of how Revelation was interpreted, which was this, interpret literally until you're forced to interpret symbolically, needs to be reversed. That particular way of interpreting Revelation as seeing it literally until we're forced to understand it or read it symbolically has led to all of the craziness that we've seen, the false prophecies, the false timing of events, the wacky charts, and all of those particular things. He argues that we should interpret symbolically unless we are forced to interpret literally. So what's the main way we interpret Revelation? Symbolically. Until we're forced to read it or hear it or listen to it and understand it literally. So the main means of divine revelation is symbolic. Symbolic. That's key for us in how we're going to understand all of the things that we see there. If we look at it all literally, it's kind of hard. And to do that, we're going to be doing something totally different than what we've seen in the Old Testament prophets. In some of the visions they saw, how we interpret those things. In the visions that were conveyed to the people of God with all of this imagery. Like, those things didn't happen literally. They were symbolic. So we would be applying a different method of interpretation to what is also a prophetic and apocalyptic book like some of the other Old Testament prophets. So I'm confident this is the right way to interpret the book of Revelation. Think of John's allusion to Daniel 2, which we've already talked about, and the vision he gave the king. Imagine if he came to the king and told him, this is literally what's going to happen, king. This image is going to appear before you with a head of gold and the chest of silver. And like, that's crazy. No, it had a meaning. The symbols had a meaning. So we're going to read the book symbolically unless we need to take something literally, all right? And that's going to change how we interpret Revelation. So as we go through this series, I know some of you are going to kind of wiggle in your seats because you have learned something different. You were taught something different, okay? If you come from the eschatological schools of Jimmy Swaggart and John Hagee and Jim Baker and all these other guys, Boy, that's going to be challenged, okay? If you love the Left Behind series and you think it's the best way to make sense of the book of Revelation, you're going to hate me, all right? So, because I'm going to mess that up completely for you, okay? So we're going to mess with some of that, all right? And so I come back to, again, why we need to understand our Old Testament. 278 references to the Old Testament are in the 404 verses of Revelation. Over 500 allusions to things, events, places, people in the Old Testament. You will understand more of the Old Testament by reading Revelation than you will any other New Testament book. That's how much of the Old Testament is in Revelation. So we need to know the Old Testament. I was studying this week, and a tremendous and gifted Bible scholar, Warren Austin Gage, who's done a tremendous amount of work in Revelation, refers to all of these references, all of these allusions, all of these callbacks to the Old Testament that are in Revelation as a reversal of time. Because he gives some examples of this. In Revelation 1 and 7 are the references to the lampstands, right? Jesus in the midst of the lampstands, or standing in the midst of the lampstands. The two witnesses in Revelation referred to as lampstands, which are the church. And what does that do? That's a callback. That's a reference back all the way to the Temple of Solomon and the lampstands in the temple in 1 Kings 7. The reference in Revelation 4 and 5 to the Lion of the Tribe of Judah harkens back to 1 Kings 7, right, which is King David, who is referred to as the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Revelation 9 and 11, right, all these trumpets that sound there in the trumpet judgments refer now to the fall of the once great city, Babylon, the whore Babylon. What does that call us back to? To Joshua 6, the fall of Jericho when the trumpet sounded, right, and the walls of that city fell. Revelation 15, we see the people of God singing the song of Moses. Where does that bring us back? All the way back to the Exodus story, right? As the people of God crossed the Red Sea. Revelation 20, where it talks about the judgment being poured out on all of the wicked. This reminds us of something we just studied a short while ago. Genesis chapter 7, the flood, where God's judgment was poured out on all of the wicked. Lastly, Revelation 21 and 22 refers to the tree of life that's there in the new heavens. And that calls us back all the way to Genesis chapter 2, the garden scene and the tree in the midst of the garden. So we need the Old Testament to help us to make sense of the visions and interpret Revelation faithfully. So before looking forward in Revelation, we need to look back to the Old Testament. So we're going to refer a lot to the Old Testament, specific books of the Bible in the Old Testament. So I'm going to be encouraging throughout this to read those so you have the references at hand. So when you're reading Revelation, you go, ah, I see that now. I see that connection. That makes sense. That's how I should interpret this particular portion or image in the vision. Thirdly, understanding the meaning of the vision. So the two main views of those five that we looked at are the futurist and the idealist views. And we already said the futurist sees these events as successive and chronological. The events unfold just as John spells them out in Revelation. The seals prepare the way for the trumpets and the bowl judgment. One come after the other. The idealist view, or this eclectic idealist view that we're going to use to interpret here, is going to see the series of judgments as parallel or cyclical. Okay? Listen to this carefully. The events are not successive or chronological, but rather events that are happening in parallel. They are cycles repeating patterns, right? The technical word for that is recapitulation. It is the recapitulation view of interpreting these particular visions. Repeating, okay? That's basically what it means. So the book is a series of parallel visions in which God expresses the same truths in different ways. The same truths from different points of view, from different vantage points, right? And I believe this recapitulation, parallel or cyclical view, however we're going to refer to it ongoing here, is the most faithful way to explain the visions, rather than trying to figure these out chronologically, right? So it's going to offer a view of events that have happened throughout the entire history of the church and continue to happen, but are going to be seen from different vantage points, okay? And that's critical here. Now, John wrote the visions down in the order that he saw them. And the reason we know that is he introduces a new series of visions with the phrase, after this. Now, the futurist says, after this, and he thinks that means, well, this comes after what came before. But that is not actually what that phrase means in the original language. It's not the best interpretation of it. And so we're going to talk about that every time we hit it and we see that. Rather, what John does is he's taking the visions down, writing them down in the order he sees them, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are consecutive or sequential or chronological in how they are going to happen. These are parallel and cyclical views. You know, best illustration I can think about here is, let's say I was someone who was going to record an event, let's say a concert. I want to video record this particular event. What do? Well, I have a number of cameras set up. I might have a camera at the back of the room looking forward to the stage. It's a wide-angle shot. It shows the stage. It shows the audience. It gives me an establishing shot of the size of the room. I might have another camera back there with close-up shots, cropped shots of the people up on stage. I might have two guys with roving cameras that are capturing action on the stage, so they're focused on the musicians. I might have a camera operator at the back of the stage looking out from the stage to the audience. I might have a camera with a crane and an operator that crane to get me some crazy cool shots throughout that whole thing. Now, each of those cameras is going to capture a different angle, a different view, a different element or image of the same event. So if you looked at one individually, you wouldn't be able to see everything, but when you get all of the views together and it's edited for you and compiled, then you go, oh, okay, now I get a good idea of this, the scope of what I'm looking at, and capture it. That's what this view does for us. That's what this view seeks in interpreting. This is what's happening there. Parallel visions being disclosed, conveying the same truths from different vantage points. You're going to notice as we study this and as you read this that the visions seem to intensify in scope and severity the further it moves along here, until they reach the climax, right? This final battle where Jesus wins, you know, and the enemy is fully defeated, you know. But they're the same things, different vantage points, stressing the urgency for the follower of Jesus Christ to continue to endure, right? So that's the view we're going to use here to interpret Revelation. While we do that, I will try to pull in from the other views, and we will look at whether they have merit or not in helping us understand that. But this is absolutely critical to our understanding of the meaning of Revelation as a whole. Because if this book is meant to be encouragement to believers in every church age to be faithful to Jesus Christ, to not waver under persecution or under personal trials and struggles, right, and to heed the warnings against turning from Christ, then we need to understand this. What is Jesus revealing to us in all of these visions that are going to be helpful toward that end? And this book contains promises given to those who conquer to the end. We saw that in the letters. And it holds these promises forth. How? By conveying and unfolding this powerful vision of the glory to come for those who are faithful to the end. And it's done in seven parallel cycles. Okay? Seven parallel cycles, right? Again, the number seven here. And even within these seven cycles, there are seven images or seven things. It's amazing how the Lord laid this out for us. But seven parallel cycles based on that symbolic number seven that we see everywhere in Revelation, that's going to help us make sense of these cyclical visions. And you'll see them on screen right here. Seven parallel cycles of symbolic visions, okay? And this is kind of the outline of that. In your scripture. It's on our online worship guide, right? So it'll be there throughout the week if you want to jot that down. But these seven visions, which start there in chapter 1 and go through the end of the seven letters there in chapter 3, are the vision of Christ and the seven churches. And that vision ends with a call for the believers to remain faithful to the end, until the last day, to the day of judgment. You will notice each of these particular visions, these parallel visions, ends with the final judgment. This is important to understand it, because why is there a final judgment in the seven seals, and then there's a final judgment again in the seven trumpets, and again, a final judgment again in the seven bowls? What's up with that? How many final judgments are there? Well, there's only one final judgment, which is why these are parallel visions, cyclical visions. The second is the Lamb and the scroll with its seven seals, chapters 4 through 8. And again, that cycle ends at judgment day. Seven angels with the seven trumpets, chapter 8 through 11, ends at judgment day. War with the persecuting dragon, chapters 12 and 14, ends on judgment day. The seven bowls of God's wrath is the fifth cycle, chapters 15 and 16, end at judgment day. Sixth cycle of the parallel visions, the fall of Babylon and the vindication of the church, chapters 17 through 19, those end at judgment day, until we have this final vision here, this consummation of the visions, if you will, with the last judgment, the final judgment, and the reign of the saints of God there in chapters 20 through 22. Seven cycles of these symbolic visions to help us grasp all of these things from different vantage points for our edification, right? We grasp this, we don't become obsessed with trying to figure out dates and times and events and where does the U.S. fit in all of this history, and what about Israel? There's things that are going to matter to all of those things, but not how you've been taught, all right? And that's what we're going to cover. The parallels, many times, are you going to see there's going to be the exact same things in some of these cyclical visions there. At other times, they're going to contrast good and evil. Other times, they're going to seem to intensify. But if we interpret these rightly, we're not trying to shoehorn these complex symbols into some chronological timeline here. These visions, brothers and sisters, they're there for a reason, to help you and I, as followers of Jesus, where we find ourselves in this time in human history, in this church age that we are in, to press on, to fight the good fight, to wage the spiritual warfare that we've been called to wage, to endure in the face of persecution and personal struggles, knowing that what? Jesus wins. Knowing that the church will be vindicated, the church wins, and our enemy is finally and fully defeated. Right? So that's the foundation of how we're going to interpret Revelation. That's the foundation of how we're going to make sense of all of these visions and symbols and numbers and all of that. And what relevance does that have for me today to help me walk this thing out so that I can be faithful to endure to the end and receive the conqueror's reward, which should be what all of us desire. Verse 3 tells us, "Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. Blessed are those who hear, who keep what is written in it, for the time is near." So we can't avoid studying this difficult book. I won't lie to you, it is difficult. This is not as easy as reading, you know, some of the other pastoral letters, right? It's going to challenge us. It's going to stretch us. It's going to challenge some beliefs you've had, perhaps, of end time events and how things play out. We need to read it. We need to study it with a desire to know, what is Jesus revealing to us about himself? Approach the book that way. Jesus, what do you want me to see about you? What are you revealing that is necessary for my growth, encouragement, and edification? We need to read it with a desire to believe what Jesus has revealed to us, and read and study it with every intention of obeying the revealed will of God for us and what's contained in it. And he says there's a blessing when we do it. But notice, it's not just a blessing for those who have a Bible that just so happens to contain the book of Revelation. It's not a blessing for those who just want to debate and quibble about dates and the meaning of the prophecy. It's not a blessing for those who want to obsess about dates and decoding the symbols and trying to figure out, you know, how they match up with world events or with the current newspaper headline. The blessing is pronounced only upon those who read it, hear it, and keep what is written in it. That means we're going to obey it. It's for those who cherish deeply the words of the prophecy, who draw encouragement from Christ and application for their personal walk, and those who overcome to the end. It's for those who look forward with expectant hope to the day when this world will pass away, when Christ will come in the fullness of his glory, and we will reign forever with the King of Kings and with the Lord of Lords. May you, as you read Revelation this week, find a blessing as you hear it, read it, and keep the words of the revelation of Jesus Christ. Let me pray for us.